I know Danny's question was rhetorical, but I would allow us a little bit of time to think about what your answer might be. What will we do when we hit that encounter with God, moving from this life to the next? I think, because time is timeless, there's no such thing as time with a timeless God, and we have forever to spend with him. I think I'll spend, if I can put it this way, the first 100 years doing this. And then that face, that expression will go to just this smile that would not go away. It would be sort of moving from this like that. I think it's going to be like that for a very, 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 very long time. And then there's going to be a certain transition point where we say, and God says to us, what do you want to do? We got some time. Right? It's going to be pretty delightful. We are going to sing. We are going to converse, which is to say we are going to pray. But we're going to play an awful lot. We're talking a little bit about, I think, what gave God great pleasure in this series, which is to create. It's his nature. It's part of the expression of his playful heart, I would suggest. So over the next 3 Sundays, we're going to be talking about creation. And I think it's timely because in our culture right now, you may be aware of this, you may not be, but April is sort of dedicated as that month. Do I need to stand still? Sorry, I'm talking to the camera now. So to our international audience, bless you. International meaning like, okay, so here's why we're taping it today, just so you know. Not international at all. We had the Adrians, who used to be members here, Dave and Marina, ask. They are forming a new church in Kelowna, and they said, would you be able or willing to videotape your preaching so that we would have that to work with on our Sunday mornings? And I said to her, gosh, there's got to be somebody better out there. I mean, really. I mean, Roxy Cavey comes to mind. He's pretty good. I mean, paid professional communicator. That's what's happening here. So we're taping this series for them to use sort of a week out from here in their church plant, which at this point is called the Garage Church because it's meeting in... They told me I got the advanced group. Okay. They were not kidding. It's awesome. Yes. The Garage Church for this time being. So this is being taped for us this morning, both audio and video, and we'll see how that goes. Here's what I want us to consider today, more than anything, is creation, who created it, and what it might have meant to the Creator to create it the way he did, what it might have felt like for him, and how he feels about creation. We will ask at the end, there's going to be a brief survey that I'll hand out to you, which is sort of our way of being ironic. We're talking about creation care, but pumping out more paper than we probably should. But we're trying to get a sense of your sort of read on this topic. Let me begin by telling you a little bit about my childhood. We were living in Guelph, Ontario at the time. It was the house of my childhood. I had a room at the end of a very long hallway right beside the bathroom, which I'm not going to lie was pretty handy. My sister was right beside me and across the hall from my parents. And my brother was downstairs on his own because he was a teenager off the family room. My sister Kathy and I were waiting for Steve to move out so we could claim his room because it was pretty nice. It was actually a really cool home. It had 2 floors with a walkout basement. If you came in the front door, it opened up to a vast space with a living room, a dining room, and a kitchen. And then it led to the downstairs, which for us was like right in the middle. Like there's this hole, had a banister around it, and stairs. It's kind of weird that way. I liked it, though. I remember the downstairs vividly, actually. It had... one portion of it that was unfinished, where I played hockey and I took shots on my older brother. But it also had a finished portion, which was then divided in 2. One part of it was carpeted, and the other part was tiled. The carpeted area was our family room. It had a fireplace and a TV and all of our house's most comfortable furniture. We watched movies there and sports and TV shows like, for instance, every Friday night, The Rockford Files. Are you with me on that? Thank you. Yes, thank you. I have learned to do that 180 backwards move that James Garner does. That's the car, by the way, in case you're wondering what I'm doing there. Okay, not really illustrative. And we lit fires, sometimes with real wood even, but more often than not, we actually lit, I didn't even know these guys were still around, actually, a Duraflame log for 3 hours of pleasant, steady, and environmentally friendly burning. By the way, did you know that a Duraflame log burns 80% cleaner than wood? Did you know that? And did you even know that they still exist, the Duraflame log? It's good times. I was never quite sure what my mom and dad had in mind when they tiled the other half of that downstairs space. It had sort of a wet bar running the back of that piece, and so I imagine they had in mind some uncluttered square footage for family and friends to sort of mingle, standing up with their cocktails. I don't know. Or maybe it was supposed to act like as an impromptu dance floor. Okay, we got space here. Let's use it, kids. I know what I used it for. I used it for what I will affectionately call Airtropolis. Airtropolis was a play city I named after myself and built upon the... Why are you laughing? That's not even the funny part yet. Which I built upon the area rug, which was forming this island of sorts on this tiled area. I had one of those cities in a briefcase that I used to use for the downtown core. Do you remember those? You remember those, right? It was like literally a plastic briefcase, and you unclipped it, you folded it out, and there was all these two-dimensional like roads and buildings, but the pièce de résistance was this tower that popped up like a, one of those pop-up cards. Opened up, boop, up come this tower. It was like the CN Tower, because I lived in Toronto, or near Toronto, right? So it was the CN Tower for me. I had lots of orange Hot Wheels track, and so I used that to run highways in and out of the city. I had train track, which I used to build a line that ran the entire circumference of the island, I'll have you know, giving all of its citizens equal access to the entire area. I had rural communities with Lincoln logs and rubber bricks, which I made by hand in love. I spent hours playing on the island, driving my cars around, transporting people here and there by train, going into the city where I regularly brought justice because the city, frankly, seemed overrun by crime. And the coolest cars, you know, were always the cop cars. I poured time and energy into that little island community. I added train lines. I built more houses because of the urban sprawl. I even rerouted Hot Wheel tracks to create a better flow of traffic. I was playing SimCity long before there was ever SimCity. My mom and dad were actually very good about it, really. They let me keep my island city intact day after day, week after week. Only periodically did they ask me to tear it down so they could vacuum the carpet. Otherwise, the city stood, and even in spite of my little sister acting like, you know, Godzilla coming into the city and crashing things all over the place. So I went to it every day, and I watched over it every day, and I reluctantly turned out the lights on my island city each night, sort of like a sunset. Looking back at it as I climbed the stairs that took me to the bedroom through the hole in the floor in the middle of the first floor, I loved Airtropolis. Let me ask you, as we try to imagine what it was like for our God to create what he has created, are there things that you've created as a child or as a teenager, or as an adult, that you loved creating and you enjoyed, or you still enjoy. Is it then possible to imagine how our God might feel about his creation? He spent not just hours, but days. Some would say literally days. Some would say long periods of time on his creation. Like, I'm not going to spend time here this morning debating what time it took God to create the heavens and the earth, whether it's a literal day or very long, vast periods of time, meaning days. I'll just say this as a simple understatement. God has some sweat equity in this planet. The Bible says that God created the heavens and the earth. Genesis chapter 1, verse 1. That's how the Bible begins. He spoke into the dark and formless, and there was light. And that's how that story begins. He spoke sun and moon and stars and sky and sea and land into existence. Then he populated those things with birds and fish and animals. And you and me. And while I had my city briefcase and Lincoln logs and rubber bricks and Hot Wheels tracks and the railway line to create Airtropolis, God created all of this out of nothing. As the writer of Hebrew explains, by faith, we understand that the universe was formed at God's command. That is to say, he said, and it came. So that what is seen was not made out of what was visible. And what he did see, what he did make, he said four times in the creation narrative, that is good. That's good. God stepped back, looked at what he made, and he was pleased. He poured time and energy into this little planet. He, not the devil, was in the details. Listen to him make plain to Job, with rhetorical question after rhetorical question, who he is and who's in charge as he talks about some of the details of his creation. So I'm going to encourage you to open your Bibles to Job chapter 38. And you could really read 38, 39, and 40, and so on. But what I've done, for the sake of convenience, is I've also taken bits and pieces, and I put it on slides behind. So, Doug, if you want to just track along with me, let's tell the story out of Job. This is where, in the end, Job has remained faithful, even though his friends have encouraged unfaithfulness to God. And he has this encounter, does Job, with God. I'll ask you a back question. I was going to pre-fill it with something, but I'll ask it later. So, this is the Lord speaking to Job. Where were you when I laid the earth's foundation? Who marked off its dimensions? Who stretched a measuring line across it? On what were the footings set? Or who laid its cornerstone? While the morning stars sang together, and all the angels shouted for joy. Who shut the sea behind doors when it burst forth from its womb? When I made the clouds its garment and wrapped it in thick darkness, when I said, this far you may come and no farther. Here is where your proud waves halt. Have you ever given orders to the morning or shown the dawn its place, that it might take the earth by its edges and shake the wicked out of it? Isn't that a good line? What is the way to the abode of light? Do you know how to get there? Where does darkness reside? Do you know the path to their dwellings? Have you entered the storehouses of the snow or seen the storehouses of the hail? What is the way to the place where the lightning is dispersed? Or the place where the east winds are scattered over the entire earth? Who cuts a channel for the torrents of rain and a path for the thunderstorm to water a land where no man lives? A desert with no one in it to satisfy a desolate wasteland and make it sprout with grass. I do. I think that's inherent here. Can you find the beautiful Pleiades? Can you loose the cords of Orion? Can you bring forth the constellations in their seasons or lead out the bear with its cubs? Are you in charge of the seasons? Now, we tend to read this passage a little bit, at least I do, maybe you don't, as a rebuke of Job. And maybe there's some of that there. And depending what voice you use to read it, we can reinforce this interpretation. So I intentionally tried to read it with a different kind of voice than that today. But maybe it's more, actually, of a reminder than it is a rebuke. A reminder, actually, of what Job has already confessed earlier in the text, in Job chapter 2, verse 10, when he said, after his wife said, curse God and die, shall we accept good from God? So we're only going to accept good from God? And not trouble? Being a reminder of that, only God can do what only God can do. But I also wonder if perhaps there isn't some reminiscing going on here by God. And so, asking the question I'd asked earlier, have we ever wondered what it must have been like for God to have created this earth and beyond? Would it be so hard for us to imagine, as image-bearing creators, that God saying these things to Job might cause a broad, if not an anthropomorphic, smile on his face, as if he's recounting the pleasures of his build? Imagine God setting the foundations of the earth, as he just recounted, in the place where angels sang for joy. I mean, who needs a construction site boombox when you have the host of heaven singing away? Wouldn't that be a great memory? Oh, I remember laying the foundation on the angels. Oh, that was good. That was good. You should have been. Well, you could. Well, we'll talk about it later. Or when he put the seas in place. Oh, that was good. When I wrapped the waters in water. Is it possible that God was partly delighting in his own creation as he was relating this piece to Job? Can we imagine the joy it must have given God to create that very first sunset and to be responsible for all the sunsets that would follow? And so on and so on and so on. We create. We get the joy of creating. Can we imagine that it gave him great joy to create as he did? How could he not be thrilled with his creation? The psalmist describes his interaction with creation this way in chapter 104, verses 3 and 4. Describing God, he who makes the clouds his chariots and rides on the wings of the wind. Who makes winds his messengers. So I got something to tell you. I'm just going to send a message there. And flames of fire his servants. So it seems, however you might interpret these verses, that God continues to work and play in his creation. Me, a little bit like him as a boy, working and playing with my cars and trains and city briefcase in Aerotropolis. I think that God has a certain fondness for his creation. Hear it in the voice of his son, actually, who told his disciples, again, we can read and we're looking for certain things at certain times in certain scriptures, but in this case, I'm going to ask you to read it a little differently with me. It's in Matthew chapter 6, and he's talking to his disciples. He's basically saying to them, don't worry about food or clothing. I'll pick it up in verse 28. He says, that's Jesus to his disciples, isn't life more important than food and the body more important than clothes? Why do you worry about clothes? Do you see how the lilies of the field grow? They don't labor or spin. And here's the verse that I think is really telling. Yet I tell you that not even Solomon, in all his splendor, was dressed like one of these. And we must remember, of course, that Solomon was one of the richest guys who ever lived. So he had the best of the best of the best hanging in his wardrobe. Again, this is God talking about his creation. It's like that's that. And Solomon, not even close. He who stepped back on day six and assessed it, God saw all that he made. And then in a fifth echo, he says in the end, that's very good, actually. It's very good. We might say that there's some pride of ownership at work in those words. Oh, you know what I didn't do from the very beginning? Caitlin, where are you? Oh, I totally missed you. Can I get you to come up now? Okay, so can you, hold on, go grab it. I totally missed this piece at the start, but it'll be worth it, trust me. Okay, so Caitlin Federal, would you applaud Caitlin for me, please? This is my assistant this morning, thank you. Okay, so maybe we'll put it right here in front of this speaker. You need to turn it around, though, because Caitlin's going to do something a little special for you, and we're going to reveal it later. It's like those shows on TV when your house is really in bad shape and they do something and they say, are you ready for your reveal? No, I've been waiting around for a month or so, just doing nothing, really, hoping that something would come along. So Caitlin's going to do something for us there. Glad I remembered that. All right. I think we were talking about maybe God having some pride of ownership around his creation, right? And for good reason. Whereas our creations, as good as they can be, as good as Aerotropolis was, my friends, there's always imperfection, a hint of or more in our creations, whereas with God, everything that he creates is good and very good. And others would agree. This isn't, so I thought, how can someone say that about their own creation? That's very good. That's good. Well, I think it's okay for God because God always speaks the truth, right? This isn't egocentric of God to say, that's very good. That's a statement of fact. Others would agree with God's assessment. Others like Robert Farrar Capon. In his book on the problem of good and evil, The Third Peacock, he says the world, and I like this, that's why I'm sharing it with you, is a whole barrel full of apples of God's eye. American essayist, lecturer, and poet Ralph Waldo Emerson once said, the sky is the daily bread of the eyes. Creation is a beautiful, multi-appled feast for the eyes that I wish we could all just go outside and lie down on the grass and look up into the sky and around us to drink it in for a moment or two. That would be better application of what I'm going to do right now. But we're not going to do that. So what we're going to do is I'm going to let Doug give us the first slide. We're going to take creation in order, and we're going to try to imagine this is God shaping it, working it out, speaking it into being. And these are the things that are popping out of his mouth. The sun, and then the moon. And then the stars. And the sky. And this, I didn't say sea yet. Slow down, buddy. Slow down. Got to drink it in, right? No pun intended on the sea. Drink it in. Salt water. Isn't that, why is water always so calming? It is for me anyway. Land. It's interesting, and when I was selecting these images, that they're all blue. I don't have any reds or oranges or really loud colors. It must have been the mellow mood I was in at the time. Birds. This is a hummingbird. That is okay. And our favorite, we flushed several of these down the toilet in our lifetime as a family, the fish. I went several rounds at fun in the sun around what this fish was called. Well, it's a Japanese fighting fish. Oh, okay. Or it's a betta, which and then I was corrected, surely. Someone said, that's beta. Like, okay. Thank you. Animals. Here's one for you. Ready? Oh, I knew that was going to happen. That's why I put it there. and then some random crowd shot to identify people. Do you know anybody in there? I would be stunned if you did. It's that random. And these are just images of the real, shadows of reality. I'm wondering, Caitlin, where are you at there? Are you ready? Okay. We are talking about, Caitlin, yeah, I'm ready. So when you're ready, we're talking about creation as art form. And before you turn it around, I'll just tell you a little story about this. I went back, we're here to like one, two, what are we? I went back to get something at home this morning. And have you had these encounters in your life where you think God has said something really specific to you in a moment where you know he's running the universe, but he's taken the time to talk to little old you? So I'm driving home, and I'm behind this car. It has a bumper sticker on the bottom of it, and it's the word Earth. And wouldn't you know that God would know that I'll be talking about his creation, which is Earth, this morning. So it isn't just Earth. It is Earth, E-A-R-T-H. But it looks like this, as soon as Caitlin can turn it around for us. Do you see that? That's exactly the effect it had on me. If you can't see it from there, what you see, if you get closer, is this word Earth. But right in the middle of it is this word art. It was God saying, what do you think of my artwork? I said, you've done some good work. Well, you did some very good work, to quote you. Very good work, Lord. So I thought I'd share that with you, just maybe as a memory mnemonic, that as you're walking around this week, engaging creation however you might, looking at it, hiking in it, working in it, playing in it, that you'd remember this, that the earth is art form. But it is actually more than that. Like a gallery, creation points to the artist. What then does creation say about creation? What does creation say about its creator? Let's go there. The Bible says, and I'll have this verse on the slide behind me here, Psalm, yep, there we go. Do we got it all? Oh, that's close. The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. Day after day, they pour forth speech. Night after night, they display knowledge. There is no speech or language where their voice is not heard. Their voice goes out into all the earth. Their words, the ends of the earth. Psalm 19. Verses 1, 2, 3, and 4. So I'm going to ask you, and this is not a rhetorical question, and I wished we had all of it. So could we go back to that last slide? Thanks. Maybe just, we'll stay there for a second. Let me ask you to make a couple of observations about this slide. What does it tell us about creation, and maybe the creator then? I'll ask the first question then. When does it not tell us something about the Creator? I know it feels like a test and a trick question. Thank you. So it's never not saying something about its Creator. So this testimony, which it is because it's speaking, is there easy observations that you might not think about until we actually look at the text and try to understand it together? Declares is a speaking term, but is it speaking? No, because it's creation. It's nonverbal. So what we have here is a constant testimony being spoken to the world that is nonverbal. That's what we know so far. What else do we know here so far? Maybe it's in the next bit, night after night. Okay, so when you look up into the night sky, is there anybody on the planet who cannot see the night sky? People in cities, that's true. It's a struggle because there's too much going on, right? But there is not a vantage point on the planet that can't see the stars. The point of that is to say this. There's no geographical barriers either to this understanding of what this is pointing to. So it's constant, it's nonverbal, It's got no barriers at all to seeing it. And there are no language barriers as well because it's not speaking. Let's go to the next verse here. This is Romans. So I'm giving you two verses that are really pretty key to this discussion. Romans chapter 1, verse 20. The Bible says, "For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that humans are without excuse." Okay? Is that one all over there? Oh, there we go. Okay. So how long? Day after day, it's constant. How long again? For since the creation of the world. So this testimony is continuous, but it has been going on since it began, forever. Day after day, but always it has been saying something. What else do we learn here? Any other observations you might want to make in that sort of line of thinking? What's the word here? What do you think clearly seen might imply? I've been clearly seen. Talked about no barriers geographically. Any thoughts? If something is clear, it's obvious. It should be, can I say it this way, maybe more easily understood. Should make it easy for us to draw some conclusions. Right? That there is a creator. Lots of folks have problems with that last phrase. So that we are without excuse. The natural question should be about what? Right? So when I ask myself that question, like, what is that accountability? I'd say it's to spend our lives seeking the answer to the question which creation itself provokes, which Jim just answered. And the question is this: what creator is behind the creation? Isaiah chapter 40, verse 26. Well, the prophet there asks and answers that question for our benefit. "Lift your eyes and look to the heavens." Who created all this stuff? "He who brings out the starry host one by one and calls them each by name." I can't even remember the names of the mountains in our city. Never mind the constellations in the sky. And he's naming them each. Because of his great power and mighty strength, not one of them is missing. Others have asked and answered that same question in their own words. For instance, orbiting astronaut Gene Kernan observed, and I'm quoting, "It, Earth, was too beautiful to happen by accident. There has to be something bigger than you and bigger than me." And I mean this in a spiritual sense, not a religious sense. And this moment of awe, it would appear, is a shared moment by a lot of astronauts, and it seems to have a permanent effect on a great many of them. For instance, Charlie Duke, a lunar pilot of Apollo 16, became a believer in God after seeing Earth from space. And Jim Irwin of Apollo 15 even went so far as to become a pastor. It's true. Astronomer, physicist, and founder of NASA's Goddard Institute of Space Studies, a Mr. Robert Jastrow, said, "Astronomers now find they have painted themselves into a corner because they have proven by their own methods that the world began abruptly in an act of creation to which you can trace the seeds of every star, every planet, every living thing in the cosmos and on the Earth. And they have found that all this happened as a product of forces they cannot hope to to discover that there are what I or anyone would call supernatural forces at work now, I think, is a scientifically proven fact. That said, not everyone agrees. For instance, prominent evolutionary biologist Richard Dawkins had this to say in his book, The Blind Watchmaker, which is a very telling title. It is absolutely safe to say that if you meet somebody who claims not to believe in evolution, that person is ignorant, stupid, or insane, or wicked, but I'd rather not consider that because he's so gracious of heart. World-renowned physicist Stephen Hawking is on record as saying, I regard the brain as a computer which will stop working when its components fail. This is happening to mine a little bit this morning, but there is no heaven or afterlife for broken down computers. That is a fairy story for people afraid of the dark. And yet, Sir Isaac Newton, who we would probably describe as a father, if not the father of math and physics, so rational thinker, claimed this. Atheism is so senseless, really, when I look at the solar system. See the Earth at the right distance from the sun to receive the proper amounts of heat and light. Like, this stuff doesn't happen by chance. Near the end of his life, existential philosopher, a Frenchman, Jean-Paul Sartre, told Pierre Victor, a friend of his, on his deathbed, I do not feel that I am the product of chance, a speck of dust in the universe, but someone who was expected, prepared, prefigured. In short, a being whom only a creator could put here. And this idea of a creating hand refers to God. I loved Airtropolis. It was a joy to step back and see what I'd made. It was logical and colorful and generous and spacious and interactive and open to change. Which I suppose said a little bit about me. I'm convinced that creation says a whole lot about God. That he is thoughtful and creative and generous and present in it and able to work with us and anything. And that he so loves the world. We borrow that John 3:16 phrase. He so loves his world. Everything and everyone in it.